Vinny.
Flaxman. Mr. Flaxman.
Oh, well, we'll worry about this later. Just don't sit there.
Avoid the first gate.
Right. Mr. Ziegenmuller.
May it please the Court, Your Honors. My name is William Ziegelmuller. I have the privilege of representing Dr. John Riley Hayes, who is appealing the District Court's dismissal of his motion for relief under 28 U.S.C. Section 2255. Dr. Hayes was advised and really induced in this case to plead guilty by his lawyer, and he decided to do so based on the erroneous advice and misrepresentations of the law relevant to his case. First,
counsel, you cite what his lawyer told him, his first lawyer told him. Where does that, how did that come into the record?
Well, it exclusively through Dr. Hayes' own, I call it an affidavit, or the pro se statement that he submitted in support of his initial 2255 motion.
Statement under oath?
He did attest to it under oath, yes, Your Honor. And that statement has been corroborated in no small measure by Dr. Hayes' statements at the change of plea hearing, and at least as to the sentencing issues, by the letter that his sentencing counsel, Mr. Dowd, wrote to the Assistant United States Attorney after he was sentenced, where Mr. Dowd makes some what I consider to be telling revelations about the mindset of counsel at sentencing, along the lines of, we both, you know, both the prosecutor and the defense thought the sentence he received was too harsh. His real crime was count two, for which he would have only received less than a year sentence. Everybody, including the district judge, thought he would be eligible for the drug treatment program. We all thought he'd receive a downward departure. How that would be true, given that the government opposed the motion for a downward departure that was actually filed on Dr. Hayes' behalf, is unknown in the record. But certainly there is corroboration beyond the mere affidavit of Dr. Hayes in support of his initial petition. The first representation that Dr. Hayes' misrepresentation that Dr. Hayes' counsel made to him was that he was guilty of the charge, that he was guilty of the tampering charge, and his counsel advised him to plead guilty because he had no defense to the tampering charge, which is a violation of 18 U.S.C. Section 1365A. In reality, as Dr. Hayes learned in a prison law library, the government likely would not have been able to satisfy the elements of the tampering charge because Dr. Hayes' actions did not affect interstate commerce, as that element has been...
Why does tampering after it's crossed state lines not still satisfy the interstate commerce connection?
Well, there's...
Look at the whole, you know, the whole transaction, everything that occurred here. What difference does it make that tampering occurred after?
Well, there are three reasons, or one reason with three parts to it, Your Honor. First is the statute, the plain wording of the statute is only directed at tampering with a consumer product that affects interstate commerce. The statute was not worded...
Yes, it says the consumer product affects interstate commerce. It doesn't say that the tampering has to affect interstate commerce. There's no doubt that OxyContin affects interstate commerce. That's the only basis of its regulation by the FDA.
That's correct, Your Honor. All three...
Well, isn't that the end of things? The statute says you can't tamper with a product that affects interstate commerce. OxyContin affects interstate commerce. QED.
Well...
What's missing in that syllogism?
What's missing is the focus on the present tense of the verb affects. The statute could have said tampering with a consumer product that affected interstate commerce.
No, OxyContin affects interstate commerce even today.
Well,
you're thinking of the product as the vial, you know, the particular vial of drugs. But not only is that not what the statute says, but as Judge Evans suggested, the goal of this statute was to deal with a form of product tampering which first surfaced in Chicago, in which somebody takes a product that has moved in interstate commerce, a drug, opens it up, slips in some arsenic, closes it, and puts it back on the shelf. That's a form of behavior that occurs after the product has moved in interstate commerce. So, on your view, the statute doesn't hit its intended target ever. And that seems an implausible way to read a statute.
Well, under that example, where the product is tampered with and put back on the shelf, that's not what happened here.
We understand that's not what happened here, but on your view of what this statute says, that kind of product tampering, which is what led to this statute, would not be reached by the statute. And as I say, that's not the normal way in which one reads statutes.
I think it would definitely be reached by it, Your Honor. If the tampering itself, if there's an effect on commerce, if the product tampered with is put back on the shelf and put back into the stream of commerce, or if the tampering
itself...
No,
it's not put back in the stream of commerce. It is bought by a customer who takes it and dies. Right? It never moves in interstate commerce again.
If it's
this statute is written very well to deal with what I've just described as its main target. But on your reading, it's a most inept statute to deal with that kind of situation.
Well, as the Tenth Circuit says in Levine, if there are several ways where the where commerce can be affected after or at the time of the tampering. If under your situation, under your example, the product is tampered with and put back on the shelf, it is sold to its end user. That is being put back into the stream of commerce, and the person buys the Tylenol after it has been tampered with. There's a commercial transaction that takes place, and that is...
Well, if you think that's it, then you must think that your client is really guilty, because after he tampered with the OxyContin, he administered it to his patients, or not, administered some substitute to his patients, just like the person buys it on the shelf and administers it to himself. And sure, there's nothing in this statute about the difference between self-administration and physician administration of the tampered product.
Well, there is something in the statute about commercial transactions and when the product reaches its end user. And Congress made clear in its legislative history that it did not intend to reach tamperings in the home after the product had been removed from the stream of commerce. Here, the product was removed from the stream of commerce when it was purchased at the pharmacy, and it was administered bedside.
Well, look, then you've got to answer my basic case the opposite way. Right? The person goes into the drugstore, buys the vial of what he thinks is aspirin, but in fact is arsenic, removes it from the stream of commerce when it's bought at the pharmacy. But that's not the way you answered that question. I don't see how you can have this statute do anything and still maintain your line of argument.
Under that circumstance, Your Honor, the tampering had occurred prior to the time that the consumer bought it at the drugstore.
Yeah, but after the interstate commerce. And your basic argument is that the interstate commerce has to occur after the tampering.
Right?
I'm giving you only cases in which the interstate commerce precedes the tampering.
There's settled authority that a product that is in interstate commerce remains in interstate commerce until it's removed from commerce. And my argument, my response to that would be...
Actually,
Your Honor,
you're thinking about the original package doctrine, which was overruled in 1977.
But my argument, Your Honor, is that the OxyContin remained in interstate commerce because it was shipped from Minnesota and went through various other states until it reached the pharmacy, where it was removed from commerce by being purchased by the end user. Once in interstate commerce, it remained in interstate commerce, and if it had been tampered with before the final purchase, then there would have been an effect on a product in interstate commerce. Once it was removed, as the Tenth Circuit has explained in Levine, it was removed from interstate commerce, and it was tampered with in the home, which is the only place left to state police powers under the wording of the congressional statute. And Congress specifically intended to leave tamperings in the home to the jurisdiction
It's extremely hard to describe tampering by a physician administering something to his patient as tampering in the home, even if there were such an exception in the statute.
Well, he wasn't charging for his services to go there. He was going there, obviously, as a pretext to get the OxyContin. So it wasn't a paid-for home visit by the physician or a commercial activity.
Want to talk about the plea colloquy at all?
There's certainly many things
apart
to say.
Apart from this issue with regard to interstate...
I think the plea colloquy is remarkable in two respects. First is it shows an intelligent and participating defendant who clearly had some serious misapprehensions about how the sentencing guidelines worked and how the sentence would be arrived at in his case. And that is the fault of his lawyer. There's no mitigating axis. And he specifically checked with the court when the court said, you're looking at 51 months. He specifically said, well, wait a minute, what about the mitigating axis? And tellingly, he says, and if there is something that would put it onto that mitigating axis, my counsel would be able to tell me what it would be. And the court says, yes. So that diverts back to the counsel who made the initial misrepresentations about what the exposure was and about what motions would be filed and what motions would be opposed. It takes back to the counsel the guidelines calculations and the judgments about whether or not the 51 months was the likely sentence that he would receive or not. And in addition to that colloquy, I think it's significant in the fact that it shows a defendant who was reluctant to plead guilty, felt that he had no real choice and was sort of being channeled by the system and by his lawyer's representations to accept something which he was reluctant to enter into.
Thank you.
See, I'm out of time, Your Honor. If there's no more questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Clark.
Thank you, Your Honor. The statute itself is written in such a way as to refer to a product that affects interstate commerce. It does not refer to an activity that affects interstate commerce. And so I'd agree with Your Honor, both Judge Easterbrook and Judge Evans, that it makes no difference whether the interstate commerce activity occurred before, during, or after the transaction. I would also emphasize that it would seem
have
to
any,
me...
any comment on the Ninth Circuit's view in United States against Stewart that Congress lacks power to regulate transactions where the commerce preceded the regulated activity?
Well, we're in the Seventh Circuit rather than the Ninth, but...
That's often.
Judge Easterbrook often reminds us of that.
I would point out that along those lines that the defense counsel pointed to the Ninth Circuit case of Nukita in which a nurse injected insulin into some IV bags, and in that case... which involved 1365A, the Ninth Circuit indicated that there should be no distinction between effects occurring before, during, or after tampering. The statute, according to Nikita, specifically states that the product, or simply states that the product must affect interstate commerce. I would also point out that the district court judge here relied on the Moyer concept of supply and demand effect on interstate commerce with the diminution of the pharmacy's supply of the OxyContin. That would necessitate a further ordering by the pharmacy to obtain more, and consequently there could be a post effect on interstate commerce. A post-tampering effect on interstate commerce. I would like to point out, or perhaps to clarify, on the facts here. At the plea hearing, the defendant agreed with the prosecution that there was an injection of the patient with a small portion, that being the coating of the OxyContin pills. That's the plea transcript, page 12. However, at sentencing, he indicated that what he did was to break the pills in half and leave a half with the patient and took the rest with him. But under either scenario, he would pocket what he hadn't given to the patient. And, of course, under either scenario, the reduced amount of OxyContin lessened the patient's relief from pain. I'd also point out that at the as the prosecutor argued and ultimately the judge agreed, the PDR indicates that breaking of the pills causes a serious risk of toxic exposure to the patient because the time-release coating on the tablets is broken.
Isn't that the purpose of it, though, is to avoid the time release effect of it?
That was that was the defendant's purpose in breaking them apart, was to avoid that issue.
I want to talk about the colloquy, particularly in Dr. Hayes' response to the tampering, where he said, when the judge asked Dr. Hayes if he believed the government could prove those elements, Dr. Hayes responded as follows: calls for a little speculation on my part. No, not all of those charges are certainly, I do think, that are true of me, but I think, and it goes on to be
right.
Equivalent.
Yes, sir. Your Honor, I can't say this for sure, but it is possible that the defendant is referring to the non-charged incidents. I'm not positive of that, though. But more importantly, what happens in that transcript is that the judge gives the opportunity to the defendant to correct anything specifically, and nothing is done. But furthermore, defendant, as I said previously, even at sentencing, indicates that he tampered with the product. And throughout the appellant's brief on appeal here, he admits to tampering with the product. So I'm not sure exactly what the defendant was referring to there, but I think if we look at the whole transcript from the plea, we come to an understanding that he was acknowledging tampering that would ultimately result in lessening the pain relief that was supposed to be provided to the patient.
And with respect to the sentencing, where apparently all persons in the courtroom assumed that he would be eligible for the drug treatment at the prison camp rather than inside the prison itself, did Judge Hendren explain that decision had to be made by the Department or Bureau of Prisons?
Yes, he specifically did that toward the end of that transcript. I don't have the specific page citation here, but I recall reading that once again this morning before I came in here, that the judge specifically stated that it would be up to the Bureau of Prisons, not to him. He could make the recommendation, but ultimately it would be up to the BOP, and he indicated that they have their own regulations that the defendant would have to fulfill. And consequently, I would like to conclude that the district court's opinion should be affirmed. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until tomorrow.